Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press.
How can he close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met. That's
terrible. One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides.
What Boehner is angry with is the American people holding him accountable.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
That's funny. Well, I don't know why that's funny.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilacs, and hey, did you know there's an election coming up? No, really. We're going to talk about it with David Limbaugh and Molly Hemingway. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast. It's number 327, and it wouldn't have gotten that far without, well, without great sponsors like The Great Courses. Right now, you can get a free month of unlimited access to all the great lectures that The Great Courses offers when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we're brought to you also by our newest sponsor, Indochino. Makes it easy for people to get, men, should I say, to get great-fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at an incredible price. Go to Indochino.com and enter the coupon code RICOCHET at your checkout, and you'll look like $1 million. We're also brought to you by Simply Safe. You can protect your home the smart way without expensive, miserable long-term contracts just by using Simply Safe. Visit SimplySafe.com/ricochet and get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote. How handy. It's worth $25. Now that's spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. And we're also brought to you by Ricochet. This would usually be the part where you begin to fast forward because Rob's beginning his spiel. Not to say you don't like to hear Rob, of course, but, you know, you've heard it before, haven't you? Well, let's fast forward to some point in the future where there isn't a Ricochet. And why would that be? But that's because some of the people who listened didn't join, and some of the people who joined drifted off. Listen, here's the deal. If you go to Ricochet and you read the comments, you know that what makes it unusual, especially these days, is the civility of the comments. Yes, elbows are thrown. Yes, there are people doing a couple of Three Stooges maneuvers here and there. But in general, it is a civil place to have conversations about difficult things. Go to any other place and look at the comments and tell me what you think. The contrast is extraordinary. But we need 1,500 new members to keep Ricochet going into the next presidential term. And that's why you should go and sign up. And while you're at it, well, there's so much more. You might want to subscribe to The Daily Shot, which is the free daily email newsletter. Great way to keep tabs on current events and see what's going on the center right side of the world. And you get a couple of laughs out of it as well. So go there, sign up. And if you're coming to us now new on the Slate Panoply Network, well, you know what things are like in the comments section, and you must find Ricochet a fresh breath of air. Join. Keep us alive. Well, Rob's not here. He's busy. He's got things to do. He's been catapulted up into the Empyrean heights of the world of Hollywood this week, and we probably will talk about that later, but we're here to talk the world, the election, with Peter Robinson. Peter, how are you today?
I'm fine, James. Aside from the Hillary Clinton is still a couple of points up, and the Republic is crumbling beneath us, and the Democrats are filing spurious lawsuits, which are reported in tones of immense seriousness on NPR. Okay, you get the picture. The politics of the day is a little under my skin, but aside from that, I'm fine.
Good, good. And that's important because we're going to be left with ourselves after the election's over. And by the election over, I mean the inevitable 3 weeks of political legal wrangling to come. Of course, last week, you may have understood, I was briefly pitched into the pro-Trump camp by NPR, which did a story on Brother Rob and Ricochet and the like, and cited the fact that this stalwart, never Trumper, Rob Long did a podcast with two Trump supporters, and
yes,
there was me, my voice, as one of them. It's not the case. But here's the thing. I wonder whether or not there's this idea on the left that people on the right are automatically, really, their default position is Trump, because if you're an authoritarian, a xenophobe, a racist, and all those other things, well, then naturally, of course, you'd be on the right, and naturally, you'd gravitate to Trump. Why, of course, if you were a statist and you looked at people through the prism of their skin color, you'd be on the left. So I can't quite figure out how those two ideas mesh. Help me here, Peter. Why is it their default assumption that the people on the right are just generally so benighted and lacking in cerebral functions that they would find themselves aligned with Trump, of course?
Something like that has to be the case. Last night, or yesterday evening, really, my wife, we were watching Fox News, and she said, wait a minute, let's just see what's going on elsewhere. So she switched over to CNN, and we spent, 30 minutes or so, close to an hour, really, switching back and forth, a few minutes on CNN, a few minutes on Fox News. And they might, although they were speaking, everyone was speaking English, they might as well have been reporting on politics in two separate countries. We have reached a stage at which the worldviews are so distinct that they scarcely overlap. On Fox News, of course, it was all Hillary, all the FBI investigation into the Clinton Foundation, all the leaks from the FBI on Huma Abedin and her laptop and the email scandal, on and on and on. Rudy Giuliani was there saying, very credibly, as far as I could tell, very compellingly, Rudy Giuliani was a very successful prosecutor before he became mayor of New York. And he was citing chapter and verse of the U.S. Code about what Hillary Clinton, what was already public, what Comey already testified was the case. She'd already broken this law, this law, this law. Fine. Then you go to CNN. And there's a Steve Schmidt, who I believe is a Republican. I think he was supposed to be the conservative on the panel. In any event, that was all anti-Trump. And Steve Schmidt said that what Hillary Clinton is doing in her closing days is well within the normal bounds of American politics. She's running a rough race, but she's saying things about – but it's all within the normal bounds. What Donald Trump is doing is completely outrageous, way outside the bounds of anything normal in American politics. I am telling you, James, I want this to be over. But there is this problem. We Ricochet, you and I, people like us, inhabit a kind of subset of America now.
Well, it's been going on for a very long time, to use my
two cubes for me, if you're making the
right. I've been using my old constant inelegant phrase. Non-contiguous information streams.
Yes. Oh, that's lovely. I hadn't heard that one. Sorry.
Well, and it's been going on since the 90s. I mean, when there were two things that assisted it. One was talk radio and the other was the internet, which enabled people on the right to be able to craft their narratives outside of the pernicious, corrupting influence of the leftists in the media, to overstate the case. There was the leftism of the media, I would say, in my era when I was coming up, was not strident and bent on certain objectives. I know from my own experience in the mainstream media that we do not start the day with a rousing salute to Stalin and, you know, sing the hymns of Lenin before we settle down to work. It was that lazy, assumed, inherited sort of democratic liberal tenets belief that right. Just that's what you believe because you're a smart and decent person. Well, of course, that affected the way they reported things because it affects what you think is important and how you think it's important and what you think the solutions are. It frames everything within the parameters of what the state can do because the state is good and Nixon was bad, et cetera, et cetera. Well, along comes talk radio and along comes the ability to create our own, which is great and refreshing and wonderful. And now the people are saying, he thinks like I do. I thought I was the only one.
Right.
Comes the internet.
Right.
The internet also, I don't know why I'm going on such an obvious thing here, but the internet allows us also to do this more and connect with people who believe. But unfortunately, what it tended to do was to just seal a lot of us off into a world in which the magnitude and importance of things mattered more than they really did. And that's why I say a lot of this the reason that you dread the Clinton presidency is because those of us who lived through 8 years of this remember the constant scandal, one after the other, one ethical, miserable lapse after the other. So here's the thing.
You mean during her husband's?
Right.
Okay.
So here's the deal.
Because I think the comparison now could very well be drawn to Watergate, what those 2 years were like, 18 months or so were like after Richard Nixon was reelected. She's going to walk into office with a scandal hanging over her that is at least as big as Watergate.
Email gate is tremendously big and important. But just as the Democrats found that calling the inevitable presidential candidate of the GOP, Hitler, every single time he comes up and predicting that he's going to drag the country back to the worst possible American situation. If you do that with every single guy who comes up, and even a moderate, decent man like Mitt Romney, then you got nothing. When an actual Bulgarian such as our current nominee shows up. And likewise, here, you know, we on the right have been talking about the Clintons' ethical lapses for so long that, in a sense, talking about Emailgate, which really is different, puts us in the same category of back in the days talking about flights at MENA. I'm not saying that that's fair. I'm just saying that part of the problem of not getting out enough of your bubble is not understanding how this plays to a lot of people who aren't inside,
right,
huffing what you think is oxygen and what to them smells like chlorine. So right. What are we going to do? I mean, if she wins, what mm-hmm. is the crisis that the country faces? Never mind the crises that will result from, you know, just Clinton's back in power. What will happen if she wins and Emailgate is still festering along?
Well, what'll happen? So a great deal depends on whether Republicans retain control of the Senate or lose it. We'll lose some seats in the House. If the Republicans only retain control of the House, there will for sure be investigations in the House, but you'll have the upper chamber, the Senate, trying to block them, mute them, poo-poo them, and so forth. Nevertheless, the investigations will go forward, I'm sure, at least in the House. To me, what the interesting piece of this is, what takes place inside the Justice Department and inside the FBI. I don't have friends at the FBI in Washington. I'm not privy to inside information here. But if you skim around the internet, you read over and over and over again that there's something like a revolution or revolt, rebellion taking place inside the FBI, if not in Washington, then in field offices. And there must surely the Justice Department, you've got a thin layer of political appointees up on top. The Justice Department is staffed by some thousands of people. Overwhelmingly, they're good people who go to work every morning trying to do the right thing. And if there is an effort to try to suppress the investigation, suppress normal investigate, if let's put it this way, if there's no grand jury convened, I just think there's going to be all kinds of trouble simply in keeping those two very important units of the federal government, the FBI and the Justice Department, functioning. That's on the legal side. On the political side, Hillary Clinton, the whole country, not quite the whole country minus you and me and Rob and many of us at Ricochet, but the press, both houses of Congress, all were lined up behind Barack Obama during his first 2 years in office, and all people of goodwill, even those who opposed his policies, had to say, what a wonderful thing it says about the United States that an African-American has been elected for 2 years in a certain sense. Everybody was pulling with him, and there was a certain amount of sheer illusion and hopefulness in that. And Hillary Clinton starts with none of that goodwill, zero. She will take office with 60% or more of Americans believing she's untrustworthy, with the press, very few partisans who genuinely feel enthusiasm or inspiration toward her. And furthermore, she'll be in a political box. If Republicans don't retain control of the Senate, they'll still have a large minority. It looks to me as though, well, we're still several days away and things could change, but it looks to me as though the worst Republicans could do in the Senate is to retain 48 seats. That's a lot of seats. They'll retain control of the House. Will Hillary Clinton be able to do deals with Republicans in the Senate and the House? That would be the ordinary way of actually getting anything done in Washington. No, she won't, because her whole party has moved so far to the left that if she attempts to cut a deal with a Mitch McConnell in the Senate or a Paul Ryan in the House, the Elizabeth Warrens and Chuck Schumers in her own party will rise up and scream and caterwaul and denounce her. So at the political level, we're facing at best, I believe, an impasse. This will not be pretty.
No, but on the other hand, she's got to remember what happened to her husband in the first term, that when he went farther to the left, he got spanked right away in the midterms. So don't think she hasn't forgotten that, because there's a certain Bourbon mentality there. They forget, you know, they forget nothing, and they remember lots. So
she may at some level, she may actually wish simply to struggle through the first 2 years and then have Republicans come surging back in the House and the Senate for his second 2 years, because broadly speaking, Bill Clinton's accomplishments, what we lay to him as accomplishments, took place after Republicans captured control of the House of Representatives.
Right.
And he was able to say to the left in his own party, sorry, fellas, there's a limit to what I can do here. That's when we had welfare reform. Mm-hmm. It was the Republicans, by and large, who kept him honest on the economy, limited him to one relatively minor tax increase. Bill Clinton was a good president to the extent that he kept out of the way of the economy, and he did so because Republicans wouldn't let him mess it up.
Right. So that may be the playbook. That's not a reason to vote for her, but that's a reason perhaps to be optimistic about what we regard as, you know, one of the worst case scenarios. And there are two for some of us. But then again, you know, the thing is, at least we remember what happened the first term in Clinton's year. There are people who are coming up who are voting who don't. They just remember that he was great and the country was wonderful. And these people don't even, you know, these are the people when you poll them sometimes will say that the American South invented slavery and that everything they ascribe bad to the world, they will ascribe to the United States because they have no sense of history, because they haven't learned, unfortunately. Well, you can learn because you want to learn, don't you? Of course you do. That's why you listen to this podcast. And that's why probably you've already gone to the Great Courses Plus. But if you haven't, let me tell you why you should go there now. The Great Courses Plus video learning service has a wide variety of engaging lectures. What's that? The phone's ringing? It's Rob. He wants to interrupt? Tell him I'll call him back. The Great Courses, as I was saying, award-winning professors on topics like history, politics, political history, business, even photography and cooking, too. So it's not just all spinach. It's a perfect way for people who love to learn to get unlimited access to over 7,000 high-quality lectures. So what are you waiting for? Get started now with the Great Courses Plus. You can dive deeper into areas you love to learn about. We've been telling you for a while about the Philosopher's Toolkit. And it's a great way because it tells you exactly how to argue and how to keep the argument in a fashion that's productive for everybody, because who wants to yell? There's been enough of that. Well, if you listen right now as one of our listeners, you get a free month of unlimited access to all of their lectures when you sign up. So don't wait. Start your free month today. Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we thank them for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, we'd like to bring a guest on now, even though Peter and I could blather on together, besotted as we are by the sound of our own voices. Why not bring in somebody to set us straight, an old friend
Hello.
Of the show? Did I say it was time for you to talk, David? I did not. I was about to introduce you and tell everybody that David Limbaugh, of course, besides being a favorite guest here at the podcast, is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Jesus on Trial, A Lawyer Affirms the Truth of the Gospel. We like to call him L. Rush Bro. Get it? And you can follow him at Twitter at David Limbaugh, where he mixes it up in a kindly fashion with the folks who take him to task. And we're here to do – oh, David, we're already looking forward. We've already talked about how a Hillary administration might be blunted by the forces of the GOP, the remnant forces of the GOP. Let's look to a Trump victory. You, a lot of people are saying that if Trump gets in, some of his worst instincts would be curbed by the GOP. Do you think that they're more likely to do that in the name of the Constitution and liberty and classical liberal thought? Or might there be a tendency to give him his reins and let him go? Because after all, he won.
Very good question. First place, it assumes that he's going to misbehave, which I did assume all through the primaries when I grew a little bit of contempt for him, the way he took on Cruz and I think fabricated stories and all that. And during that period of time in my previous political life, I was very
– During that period of time, you mean when Cruz was still in?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Absolutely.
This is Peter here, by the way.
How are you doing, Peter?
I'm all the better for having a chance to chat with you, David. Keep going.
Absolutely. This is your world. You own it. I just dropped in. I parachuted in for a little part of it.
Let me just stop here for a second right now, David. Yes. I hear this locution all the time. You know, it's Frank Sinatra's world. We just live in it. Okay. Frank's dead. Did the will then pass to his heirs or so? Because Frank Jr. is also dead, but he's got a couple of kids. So are
it
they're
passed
like
to you? It passed to you, James.
No. The other day, I read that it's Olivia de Havilland's world, and we're just living in it. She's 101. When she goes, does existence just blink out? Then I don't know whose world it is, but I'm tired of paying the taxes on the mortgage.
Anyway, well, thank goodness Frank's memory and audio is preserved for us, and I listen to it often. Frank Jr. on the other hand was an obnoxious liberal, and though he could sing, forget him. He was mean. Okay, now here we go. If Trump, at the back to my point, trying to get me off my point, I was very much opposed to Trump, very much for Cruz. And after Cruz was defeated, I was never, never Trump. I think it's ridiculous to make a statement. I'll never do. Well, of course, I will say I'm never for Hillary. So I just take that back, too. I am just a hypocrite in every respect. But here's the thing. What I don't understand about myself, and I'm going to be totally honest here, I am so tired of the moralizing of the never Trumpers. And I know they're very tired of the moralizing of certain Trump people. But I did not change my position. I did not do a 180 because I've sold out. I may have done a 180 in a certain respect. In one way, okay, it's narrowed down. We have a binary choice. And I think that's irrefutable. People say you're not supporting Hillary not voting for Trump is not a vote for Trump. That's specious. It's sophistry. If they're not supporting Trump, and they're not voting for him, they're not trying to influence the decision. They are helping Hillary because she's the only other viable candidate. So I'm not mad at them. I'm just saying I don't buy that. And the other thing is, I have actually, this is where I think I'm a little strange. I'm a lot stranger in a lot of ways, but this is one I'm going to admit. My self-awareness is acute here. I am such an advocate. that when I take a certain position, then I no longer, it's not that I'm not objective, but I see things differently. And I've noticed myself, I was so mad at Trump, accusing Bush of lying about WMD and all that. And now that I've decided that if Hillary wins, the world comes to an end, or it comes to a beginning for all socialists and totalitarians everywhere, because the United States will never be the same again. I am so focused on defeating her that I now don't see Trump's negatives through the same prism.
Okay, so Peter here, you are now. We're recording this on Friday. The election is on Tuesday. So with a small single digit number of days to go, you are reluctantly pro-Trump or enthusiastically pro-Trump?
Neither one. But I was just getting ready to admit that I'm not as reluctant as I used to be. And this could be my mind playing tricks on me. But I see, and you never Trumpers, I know a lot of you listen to this, do not tell me I'm lying about this. You can tell me I'm a fool, but don't tell me I'm lying. I am telling you, I see Trump with a possibility of having evolved because he's around all these good conservatives.
Me too. I'm so happy to hear you say this. I thought I was losing my mind.
I thought if you would have said that, and some people did say it, but during the primary, I thought they were rationalizing jerks and fools. So I don't blame people for thinking that of me now. But I see him surrounded with people that have good intentions for the country and who have mentored him. This guy has been non-ideological for so long. He has been in this jet set life where he's surrounded by liberals, and he has always kind of been mentored by them and taught to say the pro-choice stuff and all this. We really didn't care that much. Now he's focused himself on it. He cares, and he's around people. And there's another thing. The left, he might have identified with them before. Now he sees just how vicious and mean they are. He'll not go to them. So he'll be trying to please conservatives. I really believe that. And the other thing is, I understand the never Trumpers being concerned about the alt-right and the people who are so-called white supremacists and racists. We conflate a lot here. I do think there are some alt-right people. I don't know. Let's not get into the definition. I do think there's some supporters of Trump who are white supremacists. I think they're so marginal and fractional that they're not going to have a role. And the fact that some of those bad kind of people support Trump does not mean I shouldn't. I mean, hell, there's KKK supports people on both sides. Am I going to now disqualify myself because you got some jerk who supports him too? The election of Trump will not give license to that kind of behavior and activity, which is what the never Trumpers fear. I think that's totally unrealistic.
David?
Totally unrealistic.
So Donald Trump, if there were how many candidates were there for the GOP nomination? 17. Donald Trump was my 18th choice.
Absolutely.
And he just rubbed me. So at every level, just viscerally, who is this guy? The hair, those shiny, bright ties. Who is on that level? And then at the level where he said ridiculous things and outrageous things, that George Bush lied us into the war, that Ted Cruz's, all of those attacks. Put that to one side. They haven't left my mind. I'm still very much aware of them. But yeah. I'm saying this to see if you agree, because I have been thinking that I'm starting to lose my mind. And that's because, of course, I've been talking to Rob Long, who's not here. That's his fault. And James Lilacs, who's about to come in here with swinging a baseball bat. I know.
No, but no, absolutely not. David, absolutely okay. not.
So while I'm talking to you, David, with these few days to go before the election, here are a couple of things that I see. One, in the world in which Donald Trump grew up and lived until he was, what, 69 years old before he began this run for president, it is crazy, not just mistaken, but almost insane for him to do what he's done throughout this candidacy, and that is to remain unapologetically pro-life. He put that marker in at the beginning of this campaign, and he has stayed with it.
Yep.
I admire that. I admire that. Point two, in the last couple of weeks or so, now we know there was a lot. I thought the convention speech was much too dark. The staff turnover, Manafort is gone. Kellyanne Conway is in. Item one, I've known Kellyanne Conway for years. Never well, but I've known her for years. She's a wonderful person. She's one
Love
of the best
her. She's awesome. Politics.
Yep. And he's listening to her. That's his doing. He chose to elevate her. And in these last few days, I get the sense he's not a policy wonk, but I get the sense that, you know, I'm going to reach now to Aristotle and the way politics can be. I know. Well, we're trying to sell the great courses here. So Aristotle, the way politics can be a nope. I get the sense that Donald Trump has himself in some way been ennobled by this. He got into this race probably just seeking publicity for some cockamamie idea to sell something, maybe a TV show. He's won the nomination, probably at least to some extent to his own surprise. But now he's fighting. He's determined. He's gotten better almost day by day and speech by speech in this closing couple of weeks. He's been disciplined, and he's not a polonk. But I get the sense that the inherent patriotism of the man, he knows something is wrong with this country, and he knows it has now fallen to him, rather to his surprise, but it has fallen to him to do something about it. And I think Donald Trump is a better man today than he was when he went into this race. Am I just filled with illusion as the campaign enters its final few days?
Well, we may be, you and I both, we're together on this, maybe rationalizing because we have to, otherwise we'll be in full despair.
But you see what I see? You agree?
No, I totally do.
No, guys, come on.
What I was saying a minute ago. I think the reason it's not that far-fetched to say that a man 69 can be molded is because he really was tabla rasa as to politics. I mean, he'd pop off about it and have these certain opinions, but he didn't have deeply felt position, except for trade, and that still bothers me, by the way, on his
David,
trade
David,
stuff.
David, the term you're looking for is toddler rasa. Go on.
Okay. Now, Trump, let me concede. Trump, notwithstanding our rationalizations here and our wishful thinking, he could end up being terrible. He could be totally terrible, and then somebody could look back with glee, and that's what bothers me about the Never Trumpers. They say they're neutral, but they're actually rooting for Hillary. So many.
No, I am not.
Okay,
stop
well, some
it.
Of you guys are because I've it. Seen it. You
stop
guys aren't happy that this stuff.
Just
you,
stop it. Right. David,
let me put down a marker right okay. there. Stop okay. it. I am not for Hillary.
Excellent. Okay, oh, but I'm,
and I and I'm guys. And the number of people who are opposed to voting for Donald Trump for reasons that have to do with temperament and intellect are not for Hillary.
I'm not saying you're for Hillary, but the practical effect of what you not you forget you a lot of them are doing is to help Hillary in however small a degree with their influence and with their non-vote, but. That's your prerogative. I'm not moralizing, unlike some of the Never Trumpers. What I am saying is when certain things happen, like the revelations of Hillary scandals, I don't see them happy about that. I see them going, oh crap.
Who are you talking about?
Just watching. I'm not going to identify names, even though they call me out. I'm not going to call them out. We're going to have to reunite. But I just trust me. I'm not making this up. I'm not. By the way, I'm not. slamming Never Trumpers. But I am mad at the Never Trumpers who moralize to me and say I'm not a Christian if I choose what I think is the best course for the nation given the bad alternatives. But if Trump ends up bad, I don't think that retrospectively makes me irresponsible in my choice. I'm looking at the smorgasbord that is in front of me. I got two choices. I can only pick the one that I think will do the least damage or possibly most good for America.
Right. And David, I don't blame you or Peter for that. I don't judge you for the vote that you feel you're going to make because you have decisions. I get that and I respect it. I may not agree with it. I respect it. The people who defend Donald Trump as a political genius and a man of great intellect, I don't necessarily do.
I don't agree with that either.
I think they're reading into something that isn't there. But the idea somehow that only one side moralizes against the other is absolutely incorrect. Both sides of the Trump and the Never Trump side are busy being more sanctimonious about the other side. It's endemic. So let's just not pretend that's the case.
I conceded that at the first of this interview, I think, if you go back and check the tape. I may not have. If I didn't, I will agree with you now. But what I have to candidly admit is I'm only on the brunt of the Never Trumpers. You're on the brunt of the other ones. So that's my focus. And I know the Trumpers can be very – the ones that were always for him can be extremely rude to the Never Trumpers. I'm not in that position. I'm only defensive in my thin-skinned moments. And I'll give you an example. One very prominent guy who's got foreign policy credentials who used to like me on Twitter prominently tweets out, I can't believe I used to respect David Limbaugh as a conservative thinker. Now, because I've announced that I'm for Trump, not because of anything stupid I said. I mean, I say stupid stuff all the time, but that's not what he was focusing on. Just because I am for Trump now over Hillary. That's the kind of thing. And all this stuff about you're no longer Christian, and I get all these people on Twitter. So we have it both ways, but the only thing that sets me off is not the Never Trumpers being for Hillary or who not for anyone. It is the moralizing, which I think is what sets you off.
David. Exactly. And Peter, I got one more here because.
Oh, go ahead.
Let's go beyond this because at some point here down the road, a month or two, we're all going to have to sit together at our common table and break bread and, you know, get out the wishbone and be part of the same family again. So we're going to find ourselves facing some internal divisions, let's say, if Trump wins. Let's look at this. Do you believe, David, that the Baltic states are a dispensable chit that we can probably give away? Or is it important to stand against Putin and Russia in favor of those newly liberated nations?
Well, we have to do whatever. If you're asking me the larger question of if Trump wins and does something that I think is antithetical to America's interests, will I oppose him? Hell yes. And if I think we have to stand up regardless of party unity and all that. But I think you were starting to raise another question about reunification at the end. I am very concerned about that. If Trump loses, see, here's the thing I will admit about some of the Trump supporters from the beginning. They really have no they are disgusted with the entire Republican so-called establishment. And I think they're a little too conspiratorial for me about some of the things. I mean, I'm anti-establishment on some things, but I think they go a little over the top. And if this election is lost, I don't know how you bring them back. I think we've got real trouble there. As for the Never Trumpers and Trump wins, I don't know if they're going to reunite in the Trump thing because they're so disgusted with what the party then would represent. I think we've got to reunite, and then we've got to try to mold it into constitutional conservatism under Trump. And I think he's moldable, he'll continue to be moldable. That could be wishful thinking, I admit, but he is surrounded by people. He'll be accountable to people who think like we do.
Well, the moldability worries me because, I mean, his influence and his power is and popularity tends to mold those who are advising him in some capacity.
Yeah.
Newt Gingrich, once upon a time, would not have described Estonia and, you know, the Baltic nations as suburbs of St. Petersburg. But, you know, with the wetted finger seeing which way the wind blows. Well, look,
I agree with that. Yeah.
You know, again, we're going to have you on back afterwards and we're all going to argue. And then at the end, we'll break bread.
Hold on. You know, that sounds as though you're sliding into a thank you very much, David, and goodbye. But I have a couple of questions I can't.
And I was going to say, and at that point, you know, David, you'll say, didn't Peter have some more questions? And I'll say, yeah, but Rob wasn't here and I had more control. So I just cut him off and we went to the commercial.
But have you noticed, can I say one thing before Peter interjects?
Interject,
It's no, not interject. Reese reassumes control of his world. James, I have never seen you. This is an example of the never Trumpism, and this isn't a criticism. Right. I have never seen you abandon your perennial sense of humor like you have on this. You're still funny, but you are dead serious. This really is bothering you, and I think that's commendable. I'm not making a statement. I'm just saying we are focused here. And everybody is taking this very seriously.
But yes, we are. And yes, I am, because I've been accused of things that simply aren't the case. And I want to make the record clear. On the other hand, nearly everybody I know on the right is voting for Trump, and they'll all be my friends at the end of this, Peter.
OK, David, 3 days to go. What are we even talking about? Because he's going to lose. Even after the FBI revelations, even after Fox News has done its very best to alert the country to this depths of the scandal, he's still 2 points down in all the polls, right?
Yeah, I mean, I mean,
that's a question, really. Do you have a feeling that there could be movement over the weekend? What do you think?
I am very schizoid on this. I mean, I wake up and think, oh, he really can't. I don't want to say we. You really think I'm identifying with Trump if I do that. I just really think he could win. And the other side of me goes, I cannot believe. Do you realize the networks during the World Series refused to even talk about these last big revelations of the FBI and the foundation and the emails? And so who knows how much of this has gotten out there or how much it would affect anyway. But I do think – I do sense, and I think you do sense, everybody senses, a momentum shift that is really pretty strong. And the question is, what is the ceiling of that shift? Or what is Hillary's ceiling or floor, whatever. And I definitely think that momentum is continuing. We'll see if anything else drops.
Are you in Cape Girardeau right now? Are you going to be in Cape Girardeau? You are? Okay. Yes. So Missouri is a state that's in play. Yes. What's the Senate race look like? And what are you feeling about the presidential race? Now, of course, people know who you are. I assume there's some self-selection and people who come up to you and chat at the coffee shop. But what's it look like to you at home?
Well, I think Blunt will win. And I think Trump will win Missouri. But I have never been good at predicting. I'm inclined to predict that Hillary will win this election because everything I ever predict in politics, it turns out to be wrong. And if you ask me, if you put me under a polygraph as to who I thought would win, I don't know. But that's good because I was a lot more afraid that Hillary would win a week ago. So the fact that I'm even ambivalent now is a good sign. And I'm hopeful. I don't think America's done. And because
what about the Senate? What about the Senate? Do you have thoughts on the Senate? Have you been watching that state by state? How does it look to you?
Not as closely as some. I'm working on a book and I think we'll retain it. Here's the thing though. If Trump really wins, logic would tell you that he would carry the Senate as well. But the Murphy's Law says otherwise. We never get everything. And Reagan didn't. You know, he had the split Senate.
Sure. Right. Here's the last. I don't even know which outcome to hope for. Frankly, I'm stumbling around here because we're keeping you too long, and I'm not even sure how to frame my last question. Yes, I do know how to frame the last question. If Hillary Clinton, which outcome do you think would be better for America and better for conservatives, enabling us to reunite and move forward? Donald Trump wins or Hillary Clinton wins, but Republicans retain control of both houses of Congress?
If Trump wins, because I think if Hillary wins, we now have a mandate for the corruption and the socialism that is prevalent in this country, the perpetual economic malaise, the lawless executive orders, abortion on demand, undermining the military.
But
I could go on and on.
If she wins and Republicans keep both houses of Congress, you will have investigations beginning the day after the inauguration.
All of which will be anemic. All Republicans investigate. Right. They don't have any power. And now Hillary might be prosecuted, and that's a different issue. But even so, then you got Cain, and he might be worse than she is. The conservative movement. I understand this Trump, the never Trump idea that the conservative movement will forever be tainted because we got this guy at the head of it. And I even made the same argument during the primary. But now I think it might even be moot. I mean, I know that this urgency that some of us talk about seems hyperbolic. There is a tipping point. I know that we said Obama wins, the nation's over. At some point, it has to be the nation as we know it, because the left is totally taking control over the culture, the institutions, now the political system. They continue to march on even when we have some semblance of control. We have to win the presidency back. That's where the major power is. You won't be able to keep Hillary from appointing and fulfilling the vacancies for 8 years. The public would be in an outcry about that.
Right.
It's never going to happen. They don't have the guts. McConnell would cave on day two. There won't be that kind of opposition.
When it comes to the culture, let's take the words of Melania then, who I believe told us all not to speak poorly about the people, not to be vulgar, and to be kind in word, thought, and deed. Well, David, you lovable, irascible, hypocrite who sold your ideas down the river from one to the other. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Same here, you guys. I really do. I want to say, I understand some never-Trumpers listening to this and saying, thinking what a hypocrite or how self-deluding I am. And I don't deny that's possible. But the way my mind works is once I shift my allegiance, and I shifted it from Cruz to Trump because of we've talked about why, I kind of have tunnel vision. It's not that I don't see Trump's problems anymore. I do. I engage in this wishful thinking and I become a fierce advocate. But my advocacy now is primarily focused on stopping Hillary and the left. I can't imagine if she has had the license, if she has gotten away with the things she has gotten away with by virtue of an election. Can you imagine the license she'll have to do whatever she wants? This corruption, we haven't talked about the magnitude of this corruption, her and Bill enriching ourselves at the expense of the United States and at the detriment of the national security. Look at the uranium alone to Russia. This is such serious stuff. You talk about the Balkan states. All of this stuff is going to be moot if the left continues to be prevalent in our political system.
Like I say, we want to talk to you 3 months later, 6 months later, 9 months later, as we tote up the things we've lost and the things we've gained, because you're right, it's incremental. At some point, you realize that the country that you loved has changed, but it's not like there's a switch that will be flipped. The election day coming up is just another goosing of the carburetor. So I got to go.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, as I said before, it's great to have you on and argue about these things. Couldn't think of somebody more fun to argue them with. And maybe next time we'll have more to agree on.
Okay. Take care, David.
You too. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, that was fun. I mean,
David's the best. He's just the best.
Absolutely. So, well, here's the deal. I don't know, conversations like that in which we disagreed about just nearly everything, in a sense, for some reason, make me feel hopeful about the fact that when it's over, we'll be able to find some common ground. That may be the most insane thing, non-intuitive, based on no evidence whatsoever. But I know that David and I want to, there's common principles at stake, right? And with you too, Peter, right?
Yes, yes. No, well, I mean, if everybody were David Limbaugh or James Lilux and filled with such goodwill as both of you, we'll have no problem.
Right. So it's that question of
finding. And everybody, most people really do. Fundamentally, most people are patriots. Most people do have goodwill. I mean, across the country generally, but on the conservative side, for sure.
It's finding those generalities and getting back to them and finding our way back to the party from there. But, the generalities is not what you want when you want a good suit. You want something specific, something that knows you, something that's tailored specifically to you. You want generalities? Go to
call your office. Go ahead.
You want generalities? Go to a department store and buy something off the rack. But if you want to look good, Indochino is where you want to go. It's one of the largest made-to-measure menswear brands there is, and they're making it easy for men to get great-fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at an incredible price. Now, here's how it works. Visit Indochino.com or drop by one of their 9 North American showrooms, if you please. Pick from hundreds of fabrics and patterns. Choose your customizations from your lapels to your pleats to your jacket linings and more. The sharpness of the crease of your pants, if you want David Brooks to be impressed. Submit your body measurements, then just kick back, relax, and get ready to step in the best, most stylish suit you'll ever wear in just 4 weeks. So this week, listeners to the podcast can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389. You shopped for a suit recently? Bespoke? What a price. Indochino.com. Enter the coupon code Ricochet at the checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. And shipping is free. That's Indochino.com. Promo code Ricochet for any premium suit for just $389 in free shipping. You'll never have to worry about badly fitting suits or expensive trips to the tailor again. Get ready to look like $1 million. Indochino.com. We thank them for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, as if David wasn't enough, we have another favorite. Molly Hemingway is here. She's the senior editor at The Federalist. Before that, she was editor at Ricochet.com, site you might have heard of. Works appeared in The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, CNN, National Review, so many places. She's popular because people love to read her. And you can follow her on Twitter at MZ, as you say, Hemingway. Hey, Molly.
How are you doing?
Boobs. Are they back or are they out?
I'm sorry, what was that? What is back?
Cleavage.
Oh, boobs will never be out of style at all, ever.
Okay, just so everybody knows, we're not talking politics here. We're actually talking the thing itself.
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's certainly changes in trends on how you present those lovely things, but the idea that they would ever be out of style is ridiculous and a good reminder of how fashion sometimes is at odds with what's in women's best interest and men's as well. So,
well, here's the thing. When people look – I was looking – because you had a piece in The Federalist, I believe. People were talking about a Vogue article that declared that cleavage was out. They're constantly telling them what the colors are, what the fabrics and the rest of it. And at some point, somebody had to look at this article and say, here is an elite East Coast publication telling men that cleavage is gone and they shouldn't like it. This is why you have Trump. And I hear that phrase, this is why you get Trump. And in a sense, it's true. The more people feel dictated to by a culture that seems to be speaking contrary to what the majority of people want, believe, think, etc., the more you think, well, this is why, because they're not listening, because they're trying to impose. When did the culture that was managed by the elite class, when did that become less a reflection of their desire to please us and more their desire to reform us? When did that start to happen?
I don't actually know, but I think that is a really good point. And it has become clearly a much bigger problem in recent years, along with everything getting political. So you have to assume that something of this is related to people not having a healthy relationship to other institutions, to church, to family and whatnot. And they tried to make everything be about politics and it affects the way that they present this type of information. It's very disturbing.
Molly, Peter here. News the other day that profits at the New York Times had fallen by 95%. That is to say, year on year, almost all the money the New York Times Company made last year went away this year, which undermines one theory about the New York Times. And that theory is that it moved to the left, that it began to eliminate distinctions between the editorial page, which was always on the left, and the front page, which there was some claim that it presented the news in a relatively impartial way, that it began to eliminate that distinction because it was going after a market. The notion that general interest newspapers no longer had a market, you had to choose sides, the New York Times was lining up with the left, and apparently it hasn't worked. What are we to make of the current state of the New York Times and its unprofitability? What does that say about what I think still has to be considered the most prestigious newspaper in the country and about the press generally?
So it has tremendous importance, but this to me is the number one story coming out of this election. You have two really horrible candidates. We're going to get one of them as our president. hope everybody has come to terms with that. And and that's the way it is. But what has happened to media credibility this election is it's going to be huge, I think. And so it's interesting that you're already seeing some of this reflected in the business side of things. The New York Times, it is laughable to think that they ever had a separation between their hard left views on their editorial page and their hard left views on their on the rest of their pages. They just presented that information slightly differently. But, you know, this is the newspaper that in early August put its call to not treat Donald Trump fairly on the front page. And it has not even tried to cover issues fairly if they're like related, you know, redefining marriage or pro-life stuff. And people are really fed up. I really, truly, definitely believe that it was the media treatment of Mitt Romney that hit some kind of tipping point in the minds of a lot of Americans. And when, you know, the what about your gaffes and binders full of women and all this stuff, it was so insane, so over the top ridiculous that people realized at that point that they were dealing with a really corrupt institution that could not be trusted on any level. And I do think that led in part to the desire for a candidate who would stand up to the media and tell them to shove it down their throats. And I think that that'll be one of the remaining things you see no matter what happens on Tuesday, is a desire for a surprisingly large group of Americans to have people who stop allowing the media to dictate what is appropriate, what is inappropriate, how things will be talked about, what will become a scandal. And this has been a major shift.
Corrupt implies there's some, sorry, Peter, but
no, go ahead, James.
Doesn't corrupt imply there's some sort of payoff between parties? I the thing about the media that's always struck me is that it's a volunteer effort. They're more than happy, without remuneration besides a paycheck, to advance certain ideas or to comfortably bathe in the usual warm bath of received liberalism. I mean, where's the? I mean, I'm not saying they're not corrupt, but the word to me speaks of something a little bit.
Yeah, people sometimes think there's a massive conspiracy, and you see things like in WikiLeaks where you go, oh, I didn't even think it was that bad. I didn't think they were running their stories by the campaign or asking for approval for what to say or asking for direction. And you read that and you realize, oh, I actually underestimated how bad it was.
Yes,
at the same
yes.
time, I think it's more a groupthink issue. Yeah. Where, and this is what I love about social media and Twitter, because I don't know why they're doing it, but they tell you what they actually think and how uniform in belief they are on every single topic. And these journalists crave approval from other journalists. And so I think the payoff is actually the peer thing. I think they want to be viewed as right-thinking people by their peers. There already has been a long-standing problem of lack of diversity of thought in American newsrooms. And this it's exacerbated now that you can use social media to get that approval. And hopefully you can go from one small rung to another. And so there are financial benefits to being the right thinking person. You do not get hired. You could be the best journalist out there and coming from a right publication, your chances of getting hired at the Washington Post are almost nothing. You could work for a crazy far left media publication and they will hire you at the Washington Post, no problem. You see this time and time again. So there are financial benefits to being on the left and being in that group that's considered.
You know, on the other end, my editors know where I stand on things. Never affected what I do at all.
And they know.
They need one or two of you, James. Don't you?
Well, they've even asked me.
I don't know about the strip, so I shouldn't say that. But for example, Bob Cost is at the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. But you hear that from everybody who works at the Washington Post. Oh, yeah. Well, wait a minute. We hired Bob Cost from the National Review. What are you conservatives complaining about? Bob is a superb political reporter. But it's hard for me to dismiss the idea that there's a little tokenism taking place here and there and the other place. David Brooks is supposed to be the conservative on PBS. Hey, Molly, Peter here. Question: Are you in Washington? I'm assuming you're in Washington at the moment.
Yes, just outside. Okay. But yes.
So you're in Washington. Pat Buchanan has been writing columns saying that the Washington elite, the ruling class, is virtually running through the streets, shouting and screaming in utter panic. It's the last days of Rome, and the barbarians are at the gate. Is there something to that? Is Washington bracing itself for something? Is it rubbing its eyes in disbelief? What is the mood?
Well, I think you can see the panic that is there in the last few days after the information of the reopening of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified information. People really did freak out. They were worried. They thought they had it all sewed up and everything was going to stay the same, that they knew where things were going. And I think, you know, probably that's still true, but they just got very, very nervous as they saw even the possibility of the power slipping from their hands. The media freak out that was directed by, of course, the the Clintonistas over just the reopening of the investigation. I mean, you had everybody forcing everybody to rewrite headlines about whether or not the investigation even had been reopened, which it had. Right, I mean, there's just the silliest thing to fight over. But if they're having that level of freak out where they're now saying that there are conspiracies involving Russia and the FBI, it's a high level of worry and concern that you're seeing. I mean, there's no way you couldn't tell by the full-fledged attack on James Comey, formerly the most honorable person in all of Washington, D.C., is now the center of a vast right-wing conspiracy. So
Batman turned into the Joker by these people. So one other question. So you have friends everywhere. You know reporters on other papers. You know the bad guys, to put it very crudely. How do they – well, this is to overstate. How do they live with themselves? That's not the right way to put it. How do they live with Hillary Clinton? These people have been reading WikiLeaks. They know what's been going on their own side. Forget about the notion that the rest of the country is outraged. Don't they themselves feel sullied to be sticking with that she's the best they can do, that she's clearly corrupt, that she's clearly a liar?
You know, it's so interesting to compare the way the right handled the rise of Donald Trump. You have this very strong movement of people who are still saying that there's no way that they can countenance him. They're not going to vote for him and whatnot. There is none of that you see on the left.
Zero.
And since the media are pretty much, I mean, there's no point in denying it. They're pretty much just an operational arm of the left. You don't see that diversity. You don't see people saying, gosh, this person's very corrupt and this is a problem or whatnot. And I think it's best understood almost like a religious fervor that people have, and how sometimes you see religious people get behind a movement and start to excuse bad things that happen within that movement. And so they have this higher goal, and their God is frequently government, and government is the means by which all good things happen or bad things happen. And so you just have to be very single-mindedly focused on making sure that your Lord and Savior gets into the right position. So I think they're just not having a hard time sleeping at all. They just are single-mindedly focused on doing whatever it takes, literally whatever it takes, to make sure she is elected.
Right. Okay. So you said a moment ago, it still seems likely to you that she'll win, correct?
Well, so I am one of those weird, I'm such a weird person. I actually thought Donald Trump was going to win the general back in January. I think it was January 13th is when I called it. And I was I was pretty convinced of that, which meant that I knew he was going to win the nomination before most people did.
Before Donald Trump did.
Yeah. And I was still confident about this all through September. I bet one of my colleagues that he was going to win. And then I really do think that his lack of a ground game and just the poll, just the demographics of the race and whatnot, I think it's unlikely. The one caveat I have is that I don't think we really actually have the best understanding of who the electorate is. But I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen. But I still think it's likely, just because she has the actual campaign, the get out the vote effort. She's run a very good campaign, and she had to because of who she is, and she's such a bad candidate. And he never invested in that, and that I think that's going to be big. But you know, again, I'm a late comer to the idea that he wouldn't win, but that's where I am now.
You may be the only conservative I've ever even heard of who's been predicting Donald Trump right up until the surge began and then said,
My change was when that first massive opposition research dump came out about the women. That's when I changed.
Oh, I see. Okay. So describe Washington on Wednesday morning.
Oh, I had this great vision. I live in Alexandria, and there's this beautiful street in Old Town Alexandria, and I saw this guy just bopping down the street wearing a Make America Great Again hat, and he was just kind of looking at everybody like, yeah, I know you hate me, and just having a pleasant walk. And I had this vision of how funny it would be if everybody's very confident that Hillary Clinton's going to win, and I live in one of these neighborhoods that's 80%, you know, going for her.
Right.
If everyone's really confident, and then the next day they wake up and he's won, and everybody comes out of their hat, out of their house with the "Make America Great Again" hats, and they're like, "Oh no, we live. You know, we didn't know our neighbors were all voting for Trump." So I lived in D.C. when Bush won re-election, and that was one of the funniest days of my life because people were just they were so upset and morose and just couldn't believe what had happened. But yeah, I think what'll be interesting to see is how much people learn from this, no matter what happens. I actually don't think it matters much who's elected. I think things are really changing. The makeup of the party, people are demanding things. And I think it's actually a not unhealthy thing. I think you're going to see crack-ups and distortions and or, you know, changes in both parties. And I think that that's needed. So I look forward to it.
It may be one of the many nice things that would come about from the defeat of Hillary Clinton would be if some people say that you don't cross the Clintons now because people simply fear her, maybe it'd be like that moment after Dorothy throws the bucket of water on Margaret Hamilton. And all the Winkies, you know, the guys with the tails and the big spears and the tall hats look around and say, "That's all it took?"
Do you know,
Hail Donald! Hail Donald!
One thing I really like about this is no matter who wins, I think we will have a much healthier view of the presidency. Both candidates are so disliked. I think that's actually good. You'll have Congress fighting them. You'll have, which they haven't been doing for decades, and it's very frustrating. I mean, effectively fighting, maybe taking back some legislative branch control that they should not have handed over so easily. So I am hopeful that people will, because both candidates are, well, I mean, like in the case of Hillary Clinton, she is under such a cloud of corruption and scandal that's healthy.
If Hillary Clinton were to win and the Republicans were to retain both houses of Congress, that would be fine with Molly Hemingway.
Well, I am a big fan of gridlock, and I am not a fan of Hillary Clinton. I think it's extremely dangerous. But if you had an effective Congress that did, for instance, make sure that nobody was none of her awful nominees were appointed to the Supreme Court, that'd be great. But no, I've always been a never Hillary person because I lived through the first Clinton presidency. I just find her to be unacceptable. So
doesn't it seem just bizarre that things like cattle futures and Travelgate and the Rose Law Firm billing questions that are being injected into the national debate? It's just, I shudder and think about this and think I really don't want to replay the 90s. On the other half, television was pretty good, and I did enjoy The X-Files, which, of course, is coming back, along with Twin Peaks and everything else from the 90s. So maybe we're doomed to a Groundhog Day, except first time tragedy, second time farce, or the other way around. I don't know. Molly, we'll talk to you after the election, and we'll see you, of course, at The Federalist and on Twitter at MZ Hemingway, where you're always a joy to read.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly. Tell Mark we said hello.
Will do.
Yeah, the day afterwards, it's one of the happiest things that I saw last week. I'm not a baseball guy. Don't care. And I don't begrudge other people it. I don't sit here and sniff and say, well, these men playing with little balls, how quaint. No, I understand. I mean, I was here when the Twins won, and I remember the great exaltation. I was just watching a little video of what people, how Chicagoans reacted when they won. And there were shots of the city itself, and you could hear this great roar going up from the people. It was just extraordinary. I mean, it was just gladdened the heart. And if Hillary wins, I don't see Washington erupting in that sort of great cheer.
Oh, good point.
You know,
good
don't
point,
you? You just
yes.
Sort of, good point. I mean, the psychic energy when a city wins a championship like that, just the mental emanations are so strong that car alarms go off without anybody even bumping into them. But house alarms don't go off because you have to trip something. You have to walk in. You got to break a window or something like that. And no doubt that when there's a great big lunch of people running around having fun because you won the World Series, there are a couple of miscreants are going to take that opportunity to crack something open and take something home. That's why you need security. And if you don't, well, you know, thousands of people with home security systems get, frankly, ripped off every day by getting locked into long-term contracts. I've been there. It's expensive. Well, here's a way to protect your home. SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe was built by a Harvard-educated engineer after his best friends were victims of burglary. All of their personal possessions were stolen. Everything. His friends obviously wanted to get home security a little late at that point, but they were renters and they were not allowed to install a wired system. So he created a brand new system, which is wireless, portable, easy to install, and it has no long-term contracts. Now, here's why Simply Safe is the better choice. Simply Safe has no annual contracts. You get professional 24/7 monitoring starting at just $14.99 per month. No activation fees, no installation, no hidden fees. It's a built-in cellular signal, which is faster, safer, and less expensive than a landline. And I know because we had some crooks around here that were snipping the landlines before they went into houses. Great. User-friendly wireless design, easy to do-it-yourself installation. But frankly, it's unbeatable protection. It's a great value, and there's no contracts. Did I mention there's no contracts? I hate contracts. None of those. Go to simplysafe.com/ricochet right now, and you'll also get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote, which is worth $25. It only takes a minute to get started if you visit simplysafe.com/ricochet. That's SIMPLISAFE.com/ricochet. And our thanks to Simply Safe for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, Rob is not here because Rob has a new job. He's going to be back, but he's busy. He's going to be the showrunner for Kevin Can Wait, which is big deal. And if you're wondering what that means that the long-esque qualities that he brought to his other shows will now be, I assume, applied to this show to its benefit. That's what they hire showrunners to do. Maybe somebody else can explain it a little better, but he's going to be running the show, so that's great. But that's why he's not here now. And if he was here, no doubt he would have been arguing with David, perhaps as strenuously as I did, or even more so, and that would have resulted in some people being unhappy about the tilt of the podcast. Personally, tell me if I'm nuts, Peter, but I have felt that in general, over the last month and a half or two, the tone of Ricochet, posts, member and main, have been more pro-Trump or more taking to task the never-Trumpers than those people who are holding out some rear guard action for whatever reasons they have to oppose him. So, and I don't feel not at home at Ricochet. It's still the same place. It's interesting how I think the mood has changed. Podcast, maybe not so much so. And that's why we had Kurt North, who was saying a little bit more balance, please. And he was talking about the podcasts, calling out some of us, and saying that maybe there should be more. I don't know what the exact figures are. It's a 47, 53, 40, 60, what it is. But I'll let you. It was a bumptious conversation. I mean, it really raged for 350 plus comments or so.
364 comments as of this very moment. And I think there are still comments being added to it. Well, Kurt has a point as far as it goes. Glop, Jonah's opposed to Trump vociferously. And John Podhoretz, my reading of John is that he's softened. John so loathes Hillary that he's been a little more willing to consider Trump, but fundamentally he despises the man. And we know where Rob stands. And I need to know, Jonah and Mona, I beg your pardon, Jay and Mona, both hard over Never Trumpers. But on this podcast, well, among the hosts, you're reluctant at best. Or do you describe yourself as a Never Trumper?
I don't like the term.
Will you ever? Would you ever? I'll say would you ever to avoid getting too personal. Would you ever vote for Trump?
If the first term of Trump was characterized by a variety of – no, I'm serious. I'm absolutely serious.
You might vote for his reelection.
Okay. If I saw somebody whose behavior and performance indicated that every assumption that I had about his character, intellect, and temperament were incorrect, yes. Unlike you and David, I haven't seen the maturation. I don't have a strange new respect. But that's me. I may be wrong. Right.
Okay.
But that's where it is.
I've been on this podcast. I've been, for the most part, reluctantly leaning Trump.
Yeah. Peter Agonese.
And I would like to, for his worldwide podcast debut, I would like to bring on the Blue Yeti because I do want Kurt and everybody who participated in by putting up comments in his thread. I do want all our listeners to understand that we have tried, we have worked hard to present balance. Blue Yeti, explain
I'm
yourself.
Here. Well, look, we've gone to great lengths to make sure that at least this show, which, you know, this show regularly books guests, not all of the – Klopp doesn't have guests. on Need to Know, Jay and Mona book their own guests for the most part. But on this show, we have gone to great lengths to get the best Trump surrogates we can find. I think we've gotten better Trump surrogates.
By we, you mean you.
Okay. But you and I talk about guests all the time. So, but I think we've got better Trump surrogates than the cable networks do. And in fact, I turned down the people that regularly appear on the cable networks. I'm not going to name them, but I turned them down because we had Tom Sowell. We had Larry Kudlow. We had Larry Arn. We just had David Limbaugh on. We had Heather Higgins. I think all of those people are far more effective at making Trump's case than Trump's own people are, maybe even better than Donald Trump.
Okay. Okay. Stop there. All right. That's it. We thank you very much, Blue Yeti.
You're welcome.
You may now go back to the control booth. We just make of us what you want to, of course, but we did want people to understand that we've worked hard on this podcast to book guests who present the pro-Trump point of view. Some are reluctantly pro-Trump. Victor said it was a 49-51 position, but some have been enthusiastically pro-Trump, Heather Higgins, for example, for months.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there we go. Just wanted to say that.
And, you know, bravo. I mean, I found it fascinating to hear the various strains supporting Trump. And that's one of the reasons that I've enjoyed Ricochet. I mean, if you go to some sites, as I was saying at the very beginning, you know, you want a flavor of life without Ricochet, go to Breitbart and read the comments. For that matter, go to National Review sometimes and read the comments. Go anywhere and you will see. Whereas I've had the whole range of pro, reluctant, et cetera, Trump stuff exposed to me on Ricochet, and it's been informative. And it's really good to read something from somebody you disagree completely with what they're saying. You share a couple of basic assumptions at the bottom of it, but really, here's somebody who's taken a situation and come up with an utterly different conclusion about what's necessary. You learn from that, and you also learn that it's possible to have a conversation and the occasional little bits of humor and camaraderie without going at each other's throats with stilettos, which I appreciate because that's what's going to be necessary to be done. You know, what Molly was saying is that gridlock, hurrah, it would be great, actually, in many ways, I don't want to start out with saying it would be great in many ways and then follow if in a Hillary presidency. Because there's nothing great about it. But if the lesson is that the states and the cities matter more than the federal government, if that object lesson is made, where life goes on and things are accomplished without the hand of the federal government. And I know what people will say is that, yeah, well, that's what goes on every day. And even if there's gridlock for a while, we're still ceding much more power to the regulatory apparatus, which rolls on doing all of its wonderful things, regardless of whether or not Congress is voting or in session. And I agree. But that's going to be, you know, if the opening salvo of a Trump administration is the diminution of regulations and regulators by a factor of, you know, by 40%, well, again, strange new respect. I've got a large quantity of it back ordered from Amazon, and I'm happy to label it on should the right things happen. If I'm wrong, I'm happy. I mean, that's the best thing about this. If I'm wrong about everything, then it's great. Isn't that okay, Peter?
James, listen, just a summary statement.
Mm-hmm.
You are wrong about everything.
Okay. All right.
So rejoice.
Well, one of the things I'm not wrong about is the excoriating criticism that I leveled on some of the Star Wars things, which again is part of Ricochet because we were going back and forth. Somebody actually said, you know, hey, what's better, Star Wars or Star Trek? And I wanted to say, no, I'm sorry. Let's do Mac PC first. And then we'll go to this one because, you know, as if I haven't been comic book guy sitting there picking at my beard and tapping as I frowned at the computer screen for 15 years arguing about these things. But it is fun and it was a great conversation. And it'll stop dead in its tracks if you don't join. But you should. Listen, folks, this podcast was brought to you by a variety of fine things. Don't hang up. Don't stop. I've still got some stuff to say. The great courses, of course, Indochino and Simply Safe. Can visit the Ricochet. Oh, and Ricochet would be your secret code for all of those to receive great savings. You, of course, can visit the Ricochet store where you can get lots of Ricochet swag, including perhaps a tank top, which you might want to wear in order to go back to the point we were making before with Molly about Vogue and cleavage and the rest of it. Well, if you enjoyed the show also, you might want to go over to iTunes and leave a review, a nice one, if you please, because your reviews let new listeners, you know that we're there and helps this show going. But you, if if you're not. It could be one of the 1,500, the people who will keep Ricochet going. So when we argue about how the midterm elections have affected the administration, we can, you know, by then it'll be a whole new set of terms and a whole new set of problems. Remember all the things that we argued about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 1 year ago, the battles that we fought that now seem somehow to recede a little bit. We may sit around the Ricochet version of the VFW and talk about campaigns bygone, but they mattered then. The effects matter now. And what we're talking about will reverberate through, well, maybe not decades, at least the next 18 months. Peter, I know you got to get out. So do I. I got to talk to Rudy Boschwitz, former Minnesota senator. I'm going to ask him about his days as a television pitchman.
He's a lovely man.
He's a plywood salesman. Plywood Minnesota was his company.
Call it, James. Who's going to win?
I can't. I don't know. I really don't. I thought that Hillary had it in the bag, alas, and I have seen that people have been responding correctly to the revelation. Finally, it's nice to get on board. I don't know if you have independents who paid absolutely no attention whatsoever and are seeing negative stuff and just saying, oh, that's bad, me go other side. I don't get how you cannot have an opinion about either of these two people. I don't get how you can be unselected at this late date with two known quantities. I would not be surprised if there was a narrow Trump win. I would not be surprised. House and Senate, keep the House, Senate, who knows? It's a madhouse year and anything can happen. And like I say, A, what do I know? And B, if I'm wrong, hooray. So that's my prediction.
Okay, here's my prediction. There's about a 2 out of 3 chance that Hillary Clinton will win by about 2 to 3 points, maybe even 4 points. She's up a couple percent in the polls. Her ground game and money in the last weekend, advertising the last weekend, may be worth another 1.5 points. But there's about a 1 in 3 chance, I think, in which particularly if there's some movement over the weekend, which might get initiated if there's some big news story that gets dropped today, I don't know. Hillary Clinton's popular vote reflects largely her huge lead on both coasts, particularly in California and New York. And she's running up the lead, so to speak, in states that she already has. There is a possibility that Donald Trump will break about even in the popular vote, or maybe even 0.5 point down in the popular vote, and still eke it out with 273 votes in the Electoral College. And I'm putting about a 1 in 3 chance on that. House, 241 seats, down 5 from 246. Senate, 51, down 3 from 54. Why that degree of specificity? Pure silliness. Thank you, James.
And I'll leave you with this. Politico is reporting now that Trump is eyeing Goldman Sachs alum Mnuchin. It's his name. It's Stephen Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary. And I just remember that footage of Ted Cruz talking to the people with the Trump signs, yelling at him about Goldman Sachs and thinking that that was the riposte that would just absolutely demolish him. Down the memory hole. You know?
Down the memory hole.
Let's not bank the fires on the memory hole. And that means that those of us who are on this side will be called to account for what we say. And let's just all be honest and open and not forget and not, you know, we're going to do this next week, aren't we?
We are, and we'll be best friends. Well, actually, we're always best friends, James. But next week, we'll agree on everything.
That's right. We'll be jolly boys as ever. All right, everybody, thank you for listening to this, the Ricochet Podcast. We'll see you at Ricochet in the comments, and thank you for joining. And if you haven't, join.
Next week, James.
Celebration. This is no time for shaking hands. This is no time for backslapping. This is no time for marching bands. This is no time for optimism. This is no time for endless thought. This is no time for my country right or wrong. Remember what that brought. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. This is no time for congratulations. This is no time to turn your back. This is no time for circumlocution. This is no time for learned speech. This is no time to count your blessings. This is no time for private gain. This is the time to put up or shut up. It won't come back this way again. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. This is no time to swallow anger. This is no time to ignore hate. This is no time to be acting frivolous, because the time is getting late. This is no time for private vendettas. This is no time to not know who you are. Self-knowledge is a dangerous thing, the freedom of who you are. This is no time to ignore warnings. This is no time to clear the plate. Let's not be sorry after the fact, and let the past become our fate. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
This is no time to turn away and drink, or smoke some vials of crack. This is a time to gather force and take dead aim and attack. This is no time for celebration. This is no time for saluting flags. This is no time for inner searchings. The future is at hand. This is no time for phony rhetoric. This is no time for political speech. This is a time for action, because the future's within reach. This is the time. This is the time. This is the time. Because there is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time.
It's over, Johnny. It's over!